Writer, producer, physician, and public health advocate Dr. Neil Baer joins the Plutopia podcast this time as we discuss his new book, The Promise and Peril of CRISPR. CRISPR is a gene editing technology with potential applications in curing genetic diseases. CRISPR is also seen by some as a potential threat to the genetic pool and possibly harming biodiversity.
You know, evolution is so long. And so this is what makes me nervous when we start to tinker with evolution as well. I'm not saying we shouldn't have CRISPR to alleviate suffering. I think we should have CRISPR to alleviate the suffering of sickle cell disease or beta thalassemia or many other genetic diseases. Should we use it to get rid of these diseases? Well, I think there would be no one who would argue that Tay-Sachs is a good thing. But in our book, Ethan Weiss, who's a cardiologist at UC San Francisco, has a child with albinism. And he says that he and his wife would have probably decided to abort had they known that she was carrying a fetus with albinism. But once their child was born, they can't imagine life without her. So should we get rid of albinism? Should we get rid of Down syndrome? This is the slippery slope of CRISPR.
Hey, welcome everybody to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. Our guest today is Dr. Neil Baer, who is known as an award-winning showrunner, television writer and producer, physician, an author, and a public health advocate and expert. So he is a very busy guy. And he's joining us today to discuss his book, The Promise and Peril of CRISPR. It's a book he's edited for Johns Hopkins Press. CRISPR is a powerful gene editing tool that works by precisely cutting DNA at a specific location and then using the cell's natural DNA repair mechanisms to modify the gene. And this technology can actually be used to remove, add, or alter DNA sequences. So it makes it a versatile method for gene manipulation. So that sounds a little scary to me. Wendy, what do you think?
Well, I think it sounds scary to a lot of people, but it also the first stories that we've heard about it are things like, you know, genetic linked conditions that could perhaps be improved or eliminated using this technique. And so, you know, I think when it first came along, people were very excited about it. And I do think one of the things that I did run across very early on was, oh my God, what if athletes use it in order to improve their physique or, you know, get some advantage? And how are we even possibly going to control this? So the interesting thing about Neil's particular book is that it doesn't sort of just retread all of the ground that, you know, it's not quite the same old arguments I've seen before. I was very intrigued to see you had subjects like human rights and so on in it. How did you come to do this book? Did someone approach you, or was it just an interest of yours?
It's an interest of mine, and thanks for having me. Because when I was training during my residency at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, I had a patient with sickle cell disease. And she was transfused because she had, the need. But this is when we still had all of the medical records in huge files. And she had a transfusion reaction and almost died. And I went through all of the files. And I remember finding deep, like 2 feet deep into this pile of files, do not transfuse. And so it wasn't, you know, that's where we were technologically. So she survived, but the pain that these kids go through and adults, and there are 100,000, mostly Black Americans in the US, we think about maybe 8 million in the world who have this terrible, terrible disease that causes insurmountable pain and suffering and often strokes in childhood. So when I started hearing about CRISPR, I became quite interested because this was a possible way of treating a disease that was really, for the most part, untreatable. There were things we could do to alleviate some of the suffering, but not to a great extent. And so, yes, we can treat sickle cell disease now by using CRISPR gene editing. It is a very complex process. It costs $2.2 million.
But that's probably cheap compared to the cost of a life spent on sickle cell disease, right?
Well, it actually is a bit more. It's about $1.6 million to treat it and about $60,000 to $65,000 out of pocket. But this is a road I don't like to travel, which is the, you know, cost benefit analysis, which is, well, of course it costs, you know, it'll cost almost the same. So therefore let's do it. It's like, it costs in a humane way what's immeasurable, but this is often where we are, you know, in our society, which is cost benefit. And so, whether or not people will get it depends on the cost. And it is very aggressively, it's an aggressive treatment because you have to be in the hospital in for a long period of time. But, you know, we can do it. And so, and you know, how and, you know, who gets it will be the question. So that's how I got started, because it was personal. So I started to investigate, and that's when I went deeper into, that's why it's called The Promise, because we can already cure certain diseases like sickle cell disease, beta thalassemia, some rare eye diseases, some rare protein folding diseases of the liver. Why is that? Because we can inject it into the blood, and it can therefore be a direct delivery versus, say, cystic fibrosis or Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, where it's hard to deliver the little CRISPR to, which is like scissors and paste. It cuts out the bad, quote, mutated gene and puts, glues in the good gene. It's hard to do that for lungs or for muscle, but not so much for blood. But we'll, I imagine, get there at some point. So that's called somatic editing, where we edit someone's DNA to cure them, let's say, versus germline editing. And that's where we would edit an embryo, and therefore that gene edited mutation would be passed on when that embryo becomes a human being. So this is where there's a lot of controversy, because you could start to change human evolution pretty quickly by doing some manipulations. And Dr. He in China did this some years ago with an embryo that split into twins. He mutated the receptor for HIV. And that's a complex story of why he did it and who pushed him to do it. That's all in my book. But the point was, is that there was a lot of outrage. But let me just say one thing that was really quite interesting that Ben Hurlbut in our book says, which is, in around 2015, most of the academies said we shouldn't edit embryos. We shouldn't change embryos. But then when Dr. He did it, they said, well, maybe there are times we can do it. I wouldn't edit my little dog to not bark, though I can imagine people would do that too.
Yeah, there's a dog downstairs that howls, and I there's a lot of things I'd like to do to it.
So the point is that the science pushes the ethics rather than the ethics pushing the science. And so now these academies are saying, well, maybe there are some times where we should edit an embryo. And then they give this one example, which is pretty interesting, which is, if two parents who are deaf, and it's not unusual for two partners to be deaf, if they have certain kind of mutation, then they would have a deaf child, and there's no way around it. And so the scientists and geneticists are saying, maybe it's okay then to do germline editing to give these parents a hearing child, if we can do that. And I think that's really interesting, because
are you going to talk about deaf culture?
Well, we have a wonderful piece in our book by Carol Padden, who's a dean at UC San Diego, University of California, San Diego. She's deaf, and she argues that She does not have a pathology. She does not need to be fixed. She has human variation. Some people who are deaf may want to hear. Some people who are deaf may not want to hear. And none of this should be imposed, Dr. Patton says, on all deaf people. But I think it's interesting that the proponents for gene editing use this one example. And why is this example so important? It's because most genetic diseases that we've identified, like say cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs, we can do in vitro, if both parents are carriers, we can either do an amnio and tell the mother that the fetus she's carrying will be a baby with Tay-Sachs, she most likely would want to abort because that baby will die no matter what, a horrible death. But if we do IVF, we can screen, it's called PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. We can screen out and only implant embryos that don't carry disease. And we can do that now. So we don't need CRISPR for that. We could do that with sickle cell disease, but it's expensive. And so, you look at the cost of that, a lot of people, maybe Black Americans, couldn't afford IVF. So they're going to end up with a child with sickle cell disease. So the point is that for most genetic diseases that we know of, and there are many we don't know yet, or we haven't given a label, we can't do IVF for, but for a lot of things we can, so we don't need CRISPR.
I remember learning in school about sickle cell anemia. I had no idea how painful it was until I saw an episode of The Pit recently, which is which you probably have seen since you have this background in.
Well, it's all ER folks who are doing
yeah.
it.
So yeah.
I know them.
But the thing I do remember being taught was that sickle cell anemia, I think it confers some immunity to malaria, is it, that it helps protect against in some areas of the world?
Yes. Yes.
So you might not want to eliminate it some places.
It helps protect against malaria.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the beauty of evolution. We don't just have these things because they just are bad. They come about because we're doing these things. They come about
because they confirm
because
they
of pressure, because of the environmental pressure. But sadly, if you're one out of four chances, if your parents are carriers, then you're going to have a disease that's going to be really bad,
right?
And you're going to die young, in past times, to protect the many.
I'm surprised they keep picking this example of this deaf parents thing because it is controversial because a lot of deaf people do object to having.
But some don't. Some don't. And so that's why they say, but what about the parents who are deaf, who do want to have a child who is hearing? So
what about autism? You know,
we don't even know. We don't know. We don't know the causes of autism.
No.
We don't. There is no one gene for autism. There is no one gene. We have ideas through science, through the investigatory ways we do science, as opposed to RFK Jr., whose, idea is whatever pops into his feeble brain. So, that's not, it's vaccines. It's this, it's nutrition. We know it's not vaccines, but, we think it could be a contribution from a father who's older. It could be from toxic environmental exposures. It could be because we've changed the diagnostic criteria. People don't want complexity. They want definitive answers from science. Injections, vaccines cause autism. Well, that's not how the world works. It would be lovely if it did, but that's not how it works. And so, I think the complexities are what's difficult for people, and so magic thinking arrives. Interesting thing I just read a piece about a gene that was just discovered in some people that allows them to sleep less. So you can imagine, so there's been a lot of discussion that maybe Russia and China are developing CRISPR to be used on soldiers to make them feel less pain and sleep less. And there are genes we know of that confer the ability not to feel pain.
I mean, if you don't mind, how did you get from you started with medical training, did you?
No, I started as a graduate student in sociology at Harvard and then took a course in documentary filmmaking and became and then went to graduate school in filmmaking at American Film Institute and became a TV writer producer. And then for a show called China Beach, I was a writer.
I
And then
remember that.
I went to medical school. And then in my fourth year, I was sent the script of ER that Michael Crichton, speaking about CRISPR and Jurassic Park, I got the script that Michael wrote 25 years before, and NBC was interested. So I went back to Los Angeles to work for 2 months and stayed 7 years on ER, finished medical school back and forth, flying back and forth to Boston, and then did I went to Children's Hospital Los Angeles and for training. So,
Why did you decide to go to medical school?
well, my father's a surgeon. I have two brothers who are surgeons, and I always was interested and thought I was going to be a pediatrician. Well, that's what I did the internship in at Children's Hospital, Los Angeles. But then ER intervened. So,
I think the TV writer Adam McKay also started as a doctor, and I think in one of his characters says, you know, that runs in families.
oh, for
Even in this
sure.
country, yeah, where it's
Yeah.
less expensive to go to medical school.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly expensive in the United States.
Do you think that your involvement with television and thinking about characters is part of why your book on CRISPR has so many unusual things in it? You know, I see a lot of science books, and very few of them have, you know, sort of discussions of human rights and ethics and you have one piece about the effect on trans people, which,
Yes.
you know.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also my background. So today is May 12th that we're recording this, but I came out May 13th, 2013. So a lot of the work I do in TV has been about queer people, gay people, bi people, trans people. I did the first show ever on puberty blockers years ago on SVU. And here we are, 2025. Talking about trans issues, both here in the United States and in the UK where you are with the monstrous Jo Rowling. So isn't it sad that someone who's so brilliant could be such a monster and so harmful to people and so to trans people? And what is her issue that makes her such a, such a person with such vicious hate.
Well, what is anybody's issue about trans? I mean,
Well, I think
I don't understand it.
I think it raises fear in them or something. This whole issue of trans sports, there are, trans women in sports. There are so few, first of all. And I make the argument that sports are inherently unfair. If you're a young woman who's 5'10" and you're passionate about being a gymnast and you practice every day, sorry, you will never be able to compete and win because you're not built for that sport. Or if you're not built like Michael Phelps and you're 5'4" and a young guy who wants to swim, you can swim 10 hours a day. You're never going to be able to compete. Sports always have relied on the genetic roll of the dice. They have never been fair. And so this whole emphasis on this is a smokescreen for I guess whatever one's own fears are about oneself or one's proclivities. It is hard to imagine, why people get so incensed. But then people, I guess, maybe need, or at least some people need the to focus on the other, somebody that scares them, somebody that's not like maybe who they feel they are. And so that's why I think, this issue about, that's why I put this in to answer Wendy's question. I asked Florence Ashley, if there are very few trans bioethicists, she and Susan Stryker. And Florence wrote a piece that I think is really provocative and thoughtful and interesting about, could CRISPR, could we identify some genes or something that are more in trans people? And if we did, would we change those? And then on the other side, that's the peril. The promise is, hey, she says, I'd like to have, not have to take hormones exogenously. I wish I could be CRISPRed so that I don't have to do it. And that's really interesting. So I think these things scare people because, people are mutable, and some people feel they want to be mute, they want to be changed. And I think it's also, hard if you're not trans, it's hard to imagine what it feels like to be in the wrong body. I don't know what it feels like. I only know what it feels like to be a cisgendered, gay, Jewish raised male. And so I don't like to use the word empathy because I think it's overused. Like I can try to walk in someone else's shoes. Like I'm a writer and I try to tell stories about all sorts of people, and I try to work with, or I do work with, a diverse group of people always in the shows I do, because I don't know what it's like to be, black or a lesbian or, and so instead of using the word empathy, I use the word compassion. And I say, I want to have compassion through the storytelling for someone's journey, and I want to accompany them. But I can never know what it's like to be anybody really but myself, except through stories. That's the closest I can get. And that's why I love being a storyteller. And so, all of this anxiety about trans people, if you're not trans, then you don't know what it is like to feel. You can imagine, you can try, but I don't know what it feels like to be in the wrong body. I just don't know. And so,
Good.
how can I then say it's wrong?
Gender dysphoria is not well understood anyway. I mean, nobody knows exactly why people feel uncomfortable,
But they
in their
do.
bodies, but they
They
do.
tell us they do.
And you shouldn't try to make their decisions for them.
Right. I agree. So that's how we got off on this little sociopolitical journey in our conversation. So we can go back to CRISPR. So, but I am worried about, as I was saying, the making soldiers who are able to stay awake longer or not feel pain. We do know where the gene is because we know about children who don't feel pain. And they often have terrible bone breaks and all kinds of things that happen because they don't stop. They don't like stop from being burned or falling or jumping or doing things most people wouldn't do because they don't feel pain. Can you imagine if we CRISPRed people for that to make soldiers? So that's the peril part. I mean, there's a number of peril issues, of course, besides that. There's also the peril of bioterrorism and, allowing people to have access to different DNA sequences to make things that, are more transmissible. Viruses that are more transmissible would be something, that we don't want. And yet we don't have good oversight. Have you heard a politician ever talk about CRISPR? They talk about climate change, which I'm glad they do. They talk about nuclear energy. They talk about things that,
They talk about
gladly.
IVF.
Yes. But they don't talk about CRISPR.
No.
And well, one question that this raises for me is this really a garage technology? Is it really something where I could just, if I could get the right tools, go out in my garage and create a deadly virus?
No. And Ellen Jorgensen, who writes, she was the first person to do DIY, do-it-yourself lab techniques for CRISPR. So yes, you can, high school kids are using CRISPR to make, you know, fluorescent yeast. I'm not sure if you can still buy the tree frog CRISPR kit online, but there was a kit you could buy where you could make tree frogs giant by using CRISPR and genetically manipulating their genes. So that's, yes, that is garage, but it's no. But there, you know, but what is to stop a rogue scientist, let's say, who has a lab, from making horsepox or, you know, smallpox or whatever?
Well, in this country, in the United States, GMO in your foods has been a big issue that frightened a lot of people.
Yes.
And I just read that a British company, Genus, had used CRISPR on pigs to. And it's just been, the USDA has just approved CRISPR genetic pigs for our food supply. So now you can have a CRISPR hot dog.
Well, beyond that, we do have a piece, and Wendy brought this up, thank you, earlier, of the eclectic nature of my book, because there's so many elements that need to be thought about, and one is about animals. So we do have a piece by Marcus Schulz-Bergen about animals. And so should we, like, make, he posits, headless chickens that are just football chickens that have meat, you know, should we do what you just asked, make animals, you know, for us that are even more meaty or whatever, you know, should, you know, what about transhumanism, where we put human genes into animals now for, like, kidney transplantation, where we're doing that with pigs? Should, you know, what if we make animals more sentient? I mean, my dog, who's sitting on my lap, certainly knows my moods and knows how to manipulate me. And I know he has feelings, but, you know, should we be doing these things? You know, evolution did things. We've domesticated animals for millennia. We have hybridized plants. So we've been doing kind of a CRISPR thing for years with plants and animals. We just haven't done it with people. So, you know, the more comfortable we get, the more worried I get. And that's why I said earlier in the podcast that I'm worried that the ethics follows the science versus the science following the ethics.
Well, the thing that occurred to me when I read that thing about the headless chickens was, I mean, just thinking about how terribly chickens are treated when they're raised for food or raised to lay eggs or whatever. And if you could actually create that kind of food from something that was not anywhere near sentient, or they didn't have perception, didn't have any actual consciousness of any kind, then it seems that that would be a better way to go. But I'm sure that there were, you know, similar to the GMO question, there would be people who would be very concerned about that.
Well, I think it's, you know, we can make meat that's doesn't use animals. And I think that's okay, because cattle are a huge contributor to climate change. And so we can grow meat cells. We can make milk without cattle now. There are companies that can do it. They just can't, like, scale it up quite yet. But can you imagine, the cattle industry is not pleased by this, even though they're contributing mightily to the damage of the atmosphere. So I don't think it's a bad thing to make meat or milk without the animals, but I do think it's not a great thing to let animals suffer and, you know, just grow animals for our own benefit that, you know, could suffer. So that's what worries me. You know, and these are things that we just don't talk enough about. Like, you know, I asked friends of mine who are vegan, would you eat meat if an animal wasn't hurt? And they're like, I don't know. Some about half say yes, half saying I still couldn't do it. So it's kind of interesting, you know? It's like, I don't know the answer to these questions, but I do know that we have to ask them. And that's what concerns me. Though I'm not so sure that I'd want our politicians to be talking about CRISPR at this point. But I do want to talk about, if it's okay with you, let's talk for a minute about politicians and CRISPR. So I have a new understanding about the politics of the Trump administration and why they might want CRISPR. And this is the reason. Michael Sandel, who's a professor at Harvard in the government department, wrote a piece in 2004 that was very prescient about CRISPR and said that he was concerned that we would have genetic editing that would make the difference between the enhanced and the normal. And so I asked myself for a while, why would the Trump administration stop USAID, stop PEPFAR, allow people to suffer and die? Why is that? That makes no sense from a humane level or from, you know, soft, what they call, you know, soft diplomacy, you know, where you're doing these things because it helps the United States. But for me, from a humanitarian point, why would you let people suffer when it's not that expensive to give HIV medication throughout Africa? And I think the answer is that particularly from Elon Musk's perspective, they want these people to succumb because they're not hardy enough. They're anti-vaccine because if you can live through the measles or COVID, then you deserve to live. And if you don't, then you deserve to die. And I think it's this attitude that is fomented by Musk in his need to spread his amazing seed everywhere, to have this natalist approach, is really coming out of the apartheid movement in South Africa as well, which is, you know, there are those who deserve, who are hardy, it's almost an Aryan point of view, to live, versus those who are less hardy. Of course, those who live in places that are exposed to climate change or to terrible viruses and bacteria, you know, it's not, you know, oftentimes it's the luck again of your genes that you live or die. It's not because you're chosen by God or you're special. So I think that this has gotten into the Trump administration. It's really bad. I saw it in an article in The Atlantic recently, and they call it soft genetics. And I think that makes sense. This is why they're not sending money around the world anymore, because let these people die, let them see what happens. And then, you know, those who should live will live. And I think CRISPR, but then I think on the other hand, because there's always contradictions in their thinking, they wouldn't stop for a moment to buy CRISPR if it could enhance their kids too. So you get these complex situations that are happening now.
This is making me think about Gattaca.
Yes.
You remember that film, Gattaca? I mean, that's kind of the thing that I kept thinking about. I mean, I have a sense, as you're saying, that they're kind of more into survival of the fittest and so forth, and that they would not have any scruples about eugenics, basically.
Oh, absolutely.
Getting into big time eugenics.
Absolutely. Because why would you stop funding USAID and PEPFAR? What? Because it's expensive? No, it's not. You know, he's going to spend, what, $100 million on his parade for his birthday? I mean, come on. It's not expensive to save lives the way we all have been saving lives. So something else is going on.
Well, and why would they dismantle our mechanisms for food safety, for that matter? Why? I mean, they're basically getting rid of all the things that exist to keep people safe and healthy and you know, to preserve life.
That's right, because let the let the fittest survive. Now, of course, the fittest have means to survive. That's the contradiction. Like, they have refrigerators and they have, you know, access to clean food and clean water and all of those things. And so we still got this situation. And I think that they would definitely embrace CRISPR, you know, because they see that as something that maybe they deserve or, you know, are entitled to.
Now I'm thinking about the boys from Brazil and worrying about Trump clones.
Right. Well, that's the boys.
But, yeah, but this is this kind of thing. I mean, it's very common. I remember when I lived in Ireland in the 1980s, I remember talking to somebody about abortion. And she said, you know, I think she was a nurse or something, and she'd seen the impact of the abortion ban that was total in Ireland at that time. And she said, you know, all these conservatives are really against abortion until it's their daughter, and then that's an exceptional circumstance. But that's a special circumstance. It's exceptional. It's not. It doesn't lead them to say, oh, everybody should have access to this. It was just kind of, well, my daughter is special.
But isn't that always the case? It's well known that Nancy Reagan had abortions. It's known that Grindr went berserk during the Republican convention in Milwaukee. So there's a lot. I mean, that was known. It stopped working because they, you know, it's well known that there are certain senators in the United States who are rabid Trump-loving Republicans who are gay. So, you know, people are complex and people have shame and people say a lot of things and do other things in secret because of their shame and their fear. And so, you know, the terrible things that happened in Ireland with, you know, that we know about now with young women and in these unwed mothers.
Sometimes they knew even at the time. I remember being told a story about a young woman that, you know, her entire village knew she was pregnant. They all knew it was her father and they all just were completely quiet.
Well, it's yes. We'll see how Pope Leo deals with, you know, sexual abuse in the church. Apparently he didn't deal with it so well when he was, you know, a priest. But that's what's interesting about people, right? We all have secrets. We all do things in secret that we might not be proud of or we, you know, might rally against. So, but I think when we try to make other people do things or live a certain way that outwardly we think is right, even though inwardly we think is, you know, maybe different, is problematic. There have been numbers of queer, particularly Republican congressmen who were very virulent anti-homosexual who were, you know, gay. And so that's about shame and fear, and those are huge motivators. I don't think CRISPR can change that quite yet, but it's a really, it's a tough time. And I think social media doesn't help because, you know, it just gives us an echo chamber, you know, to be reinforced. That's why I love doing ER. You know, I did an episode in year two where George Clooney saves a kid in a tunnel and I had 48 million viewers.
I remember that episode.
And I love that episode.
We're never going to have that many viewers again. Everybody can niche their desires. If you want to watch, you know.
But you will have that number of viewers over time. You just won't have them all at once.
But when you had them all at once, the next day they talked about it.
I know.
You're still in a silo.
Actually, the episode of yours that I really liked was the one in the blizzard.
Oh, that was beautiful. Yeah.
I love the goofiness it started with and how
yes,
it's very like some MASH episodes where they're all goofing around and then the wounded
and,
are
whoa.
All, and then they all get back to work.
And you know, I did hear, Wendy, a story about a Russian doctor who came to the United States and then there was some, you know, crisis where he did something. He was a custodian and it was like, oh my God, why did he do this? He can't do this. And then they found out he was a doctor. He saved someone's life and that became someone in our episode.
That became Bob.
That was Bob. Yes,
yes.
Exactly. Exactly. So it does come from real life in so many ways that the shows I did.
I'm seeing a lot of conversation about the Pitt, though, and certain other shows that really are able to attract quite a bit of attention. They're actually considered newsworthy. I mean, you're seeing news stories about episodes of specific shows, and that means that there are at least some people there is still a large group of people who are watching television and being
Oh,
influenced
yes.
by it and
Oh,
discussing
absolutely.
it. And
But everything, it's like, old shows and new TV sets. Because old wine and new bottles. It's like, I think there was conversation about cardiopulmonary resuscitation, yada, 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 today. And I've seen it over the years. Well, I did a piece in the New England Journal in 1995 about whether or not CPR was presented realistically or not. So that's old TV and new TV sets. It's like, yeah, because we're still talking about these things, and there's new journalists and new viewers, but there's not so much new. I mean, ER was new, truly new, because of the technology, and that technology was the Steadicam.
I was good, but
Steadicam.
it's also the medical technology. I was looking at this recently. I looked at an episode of Dr. Kildare and an episode of
Yes.
St. Elsewhere and an episode of ER and an episode of The Pitt. And you can the biggest change in medical technology, it seems to me, was between St. Elsewhere and
ER.
ER.
And the
Where
reason
did
is, there's one reason. I'm the first doctor writer in TV.
you...
No, that's true. There were
I
no
believe
doctors.
you, but there was
There were
also
no, there were,
a lot more machinery
well,
in
there were no doctors. There were no doctor writers in medical shows. The shows were written always about the patient for the most part and the doctor saving their life. And then the doctors would come in and sprinkle the medicine on top. ER was the first medical series that had doctors in the writing room, and people would say, "Oh, you were a consultant." No, I was not a consultant. I was a writer on the show. I came up with the medical stories, and we were the first show to have doctors on the set make it look real. So they taught Noah Wiley and Eric Lassalle how to sew using chicken parts. So that made it look real. So it was the first show to use doctors both on the set and in the writer's room. And that changed everything. There are no medical series since ER that have no doctor writers. Grey's Anatomy had doctors, House had doctors from the very beginning, New Amsterdam. They all have doctors on the show. The Resident, good medical series and not so good, all have doctors. Just like David Kelly was really the first lawyer writer when he did LA Law, and now there are no legal shows without lawyers writing
And
because.
it really showed on The Good Wife. It was such a good show because of the way it talked about law.
And the writer and the audience wants that verisimilitude. And so now The Pitt, so I'm told, is gorier because it's on HBO, and Pulse is on Netflix. And so you see more blood and guts and stuff, but it's still the same kind of medical series.
Well, it looks pretty real.
Yeah, but
But that raises.
ER looked real. I
Well, it
mean,
raises a question for me. How hard is it to be medically accurate and at the same time serve the story?
it's not hard at all. And that's why we have Hollywood Health and Society that came about. Because I was always calling the CDC for material, and I was calling professors at Harvard. And I worked with them at the very beginning. Norman Lear gave money to USC, University of Southern California, and they're very much involved still. It's called Hollywood Health and Society. And they provide accurate information to any writer in Hollywood on any medical issue. And so there's no excuse for giving inaccurate information. And fortunately, standards and practices at all of the networks want the data so that They're not presenting something that's inaccurate. Now, the speed and things like that is not accurate, like, you know, to get the results, boom, right away, et cetera, is, but we don't want to tell people, like, I remember there was a show maybe 15 years ago that did say something about autism and vaccines, and they got in trouble. And that's really when the networks said no more of that. And so I don't think you're going to see, even in the Trump administration, I could be wrong because I haven't been watching network TV, and there aren't really many medical shows on network TV now, where you would hear a doctor say, I can't give you a vaccination because you might get autism. That's not going to happen. But Hollywood Health and Society are really responsible in Los Angeles for providing accurate information. So, you know, the time frame is different. But, you know, one hopes that, you know, it's accurate. And we did a study. I was the first person to do a study with Kaiser Family Foundation on what people learn from television. And it was published in the journal Health Affairs in 2001. And we looked at human papillomavirus and cervical cancer and what people learned from an episode of ER. And we were shocked. Before the episode aired, viewers about 20% knew that HPV caused cervical cancer. After the show aired, 60%. Whoa. So that was a reason why we wanted to be accurate.
Well, back to CRISPR. I was just reading this week that the patent rights of CRISPR are being disputed once again. University of California and University of Vienna have reactivated that whole dispute. How did this come about, and do you think this could possibly impair, you know, developments in CRISPR?
Well, it depends what the courts say, but, you know, the University of California did not invent CRISPR. CRISPR came out of Danone yogurt, and the researchers at Danone yogurt noticed that some yogurt cultures were doing okay and others weren't, and they started to investigate, and they saw what bacteria was doing on cutting up viruses and then incorporating them into their genome. And so that was the beginning of CRISPR. So whether a company should own a patent that can, is very complex, because, you know, we start to question, like, can you own parts of the genome? You know, if you're like, you know, doing this, you might be able to own the technique. But there's so much we don't know. Let me give you an example from recently that I talked about in a talk I gave. There's a gene called PCSK9. And PCSK9 controls LDL cholesterol. And we know that from great scientific research. So there's a company that can knock out a letter in the DNA that can suppress PCSK9, and it's been very effective in trials for reducing LDL in people where they haven't responded well to statins, cholesterol drugs that reduce cholesterol. And so, and in their research, they haven't seen any impact in the 4-hour infusion, you know, giving this CRISPR drug that then deletes and changes the letter and puts in a different one. But the question is, if you look at some really interesting AI platforms, they look at, you know, the genetic evolution of a gene. And PCSK9 has been around for a couple billion years. And it doesn't just control LDL. It controls or contributes to many different things. Our bodies are so complex. So yes, we could knock out this gene and make it so that LDL is reduced and these people have a much lower risk of heart disease. But this gene does many other things. It's part of a cascade of genes. And I think we're rushing to make money by doing these things for good reason, for good, but also to make money. And they go hand in hand. They're going to make a lot of money if they can make this work and it's safe, quote, safe. But over a long period of time, I don't know if it's safe or not. And I know that it controls many other aspects, and I don't know enough. I'm not a geneticist to know the intricacies of the control, but I do know from looking at the research that PCSK9 has many different mechanisms, not just LDL production. So it's a cautionary, it's a caution that before we just start chopping things up, what do we want to know? We need to really be clear about that. And I don't see that happening when I saw a presentation on this gene. It was all rah, rah, no side effects from the 4-hour infusion and LDL reduced 69%. But I didn't hear anybody talk about the cascade of other metabolic elements related to PCSK9 and would that affect anything? We do know, to go back to Wendy much earlier, that when she asked about sickle cell disease and that people who are carriers may have some protection for malaria. And they're not like perfectly healthy in the same way as people who are not carriers. There are side effects too. They're just not talked about, but not to the extent of having sickle cell disease. But the twins who were CRISPRed and their receptor for HIV was mutated, there's some question now that those people who did not contract HIV, who were exposed to it, that small minority who lived through the horrible pandemic, they may be more susceptible to other things like West Nile virus or things. So it's not just like evolution just pops around, you
There's an
know?
interesting example of that. I don't know if you've ever heard of the town of Eme in Britain, but it's a small town in Derbyshire where it's called the Plague Village. And when the plague hit London, it hit this village in Derbyshire. And they weren't there's very th various theories why. But the point is that the village made the very brave decision to cut itself off from the rest of the world so that it didn't infect other people. And there was a neighboring village that brought food and left it on the banks of the river, and then somebody would go and pick it up. And there was the whole thing. And there's a couple of warring museums in this tiny little village. But the point is that some people survived. And I believe their descendants are still being studied today to understand why
Absolutely.
and what it means.
Right. And that's a little tiny piece of evolution. Evolution is so long. And so this is what makes me nervous when we start to tinker with evolution as well. I'm not saying we shouldn't have CRISPR to alleviate suffering. I think we should have CRISPR to alleviate the suffering of sickle cell disease or beta thalassemia or many other genetic diseases. Should we use it to get rid of these diseases? Well, I think there would be no one who would argue that Tay-Sachs is a good thing. But in our book, Ethan Weiss, who's a cardiologist at UC San Francisco, has a child with albinism. And he says that he and his wife would have probably decided to abort had they known that she was carrying a fetus with albinism. But once their child was born, they can't imagine life without her. So, should we get rid of albinism? Should we get rid of Down syndrome? This is the slippery slope of CRISPR. So, the slippery slope of CRISPR is who makes the decision about whom should be CRISPRed and what, genetic disorders or genetic syndromes should be CRISPRed. So I think nobody would argue that Tay-Sachs is a horrible disease. Do we need CRISPR for Tay-Sachs? No, because we can use IVF and separate CRISPRed eggs. But some people have argued, like George Churchill from Harvard, that we should use CRISPR just to eliminate genetic diseases. So, for instance, if two parents had Tay-Sachs, you could just conceivably edit them so that they don't carry Tay-Sachs anymore. But that's a little bit into the future. But the point is that some diseases like Tay-Sachs disease, which are always fatal and profoundly tragic because the child dies quite young, there's no cure, no treatment. No one would argue, I think, that we should get rid of that disease if we could. But then we have Down syndrome or albinism, and we have an article in our book about written by Ethan Weiss, who's a cardiologist from UC San Francisco, who has a child with albinism. And he argues in his book or says that had he and his wife known they were carrying a child with albinism, they probably would have aborted the fetus. But they didn't know they had the baby. The baby's grown up and has changed their life in the most profoundly positive ways. And they can't imagine, he says, not having her. So where do we draw the line? There are people with Down syndrome who live very productive lives on their own. I worked with an actor some years ago on SVU, and she lived on her own and she had acted on many series. There are others who need, to be, taken care of and supervised. There's a range of folks, just like in real life. We have ranges of abilities and things. So who's going to make that decision? Should we just like get rid of, quote, get rid of diseases?
Well, doesn't it to some
Where do you
extent
draw
have
the
to,
line?
doesn't it to some extent have to be up to the parents? I mean, it seems to me quite an imposition for someone to say, well, yes, we know that this baby is going to have a terrible disease and you're going to struggle all your life to take care of it, but that's your problem. I don't think that's a very good answer.
I don't think so either, but I look at the Trump administration and not giving money for PEPFAR and USAID, saying, "Let your kids die."
Yes, I
Those
agree.
children
That's
didn't, they're making that decision for, people saying, "We're not going to provide the money, so too bad, die." So they're making that decision. So what's to stop? I guess, Wendy, what I'm saying is, yeah, I agree that it could be up to parents. But who's, what happens when the government starts getting involved in making decisions?
Well, there's this whole thing about how, we assume as humans that we have so much more control than we probably actually have over nature, over, I mean, if an asteroid is hurling toward Earth, how much control do we have over that? And how much control can we really have over genetic structures and given their complexity? How safe it is it, well, you already made this point. How safe is it to try to control for one thing, not knowing what the unintended consequences might be?
Right. So you raised two important points. One about unintended consequences. So we thought, in the Industrial Revolution that, fossil fuels were, God's gift to mankind. Well, they've really improved our lives in countless ways, but also we have climate change. We have real threat from burning fossil fuels. We could say the same thing about plastics. We could say the same thing about a lot of things. We call that dual-use technology. Really great things come of it, and possible really bad things. So that's really important to think about. We don't know what the consequences are going to be. We didn't know about nanoplastics. We didn't know, in the 18th and 19th century necessarily. I mean, we saw soot and bad things, but we didn't know, the consequences necessarily, though we did know many years ago, but the oil companies covered it up, what they did know. Now there are big lawsuits about that. The other thing, point, John, is that, and we haven't talked, is off-target problems with CRISPR. So, CRISPR continues to be refined, but there are still sometimes off-target mutations where you mutate one part of a gene, but other things happen because genes are so complex, as I was saying earlier about the LDL gene. So we don't know for sure down the line. And we have Robert Sparrow's piece about that, that we just don't even know about IVF. It's so new. We don't know if there are any consequences, really. Probably not so far, but you know, it takes time and research. So there are a lot of you know, potholes on this road that, you know, we keep trying to we endeavor to fix, like off-target mutations, but still things happen, you know, and you know, and that's, you know, how life goes. Some people are born with all kinds of, you know, mutations that don't have an impact, apparently, and some do. We don't know enough yet, but we still march forward and say, well, maybe it's okay to do it. Is it? That's where I get to the point where conversations about this and really teaching young people about the science is so incredibly important today. And I worry about that, where money's being pulled away from public schools. And, you know, if you're not informed, and look how complex this is. And to be informed takes a lot of work. And, you know, there's going to be the informed and the uninformed. And that's
I think one of our political problems now is that we have people who not only don't know, but they don't care.
Right.
And that's a real problem.
I was talking to an editor at the New York Times recently, and he said that his big worry was that people were thinking and saying that facts themselves are elitist.
Oh, it's like, I don't know what to do with that.
I don't know either. I mean, but you kind of see that in magical thinking, and, you know, we have research. You know, the Health and Human Services just published something that came out about promoting conversion therapy again for gay and trans people. And they have refused to publish the authors of this study.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so, yes, it is interesting because we don't know who they are, but I do know from people who are researchers at Harvard, where I teach at Harvard Medical School, that it's this cherry-picked mess that is not empirically sound delivered in this publication from RFK. And so what do you do about that? You know, you can have people write things and pull things and have opinions, but when you're doing things, you know, when you're approaching these questions about, say, puberty blockers, you really need to look at the research, and that's often not done. And so that's the worry. And then you kind of you make it even more complex by then bringing in religious views and saying, you know, that this is what the Bible says, and therefore it's my religious view, and I'm a therapist, and I have the right to do my therapy based on my religious views. So that's a case that's coming, that will come up before the Supreme Court, I believe, from Colorado. Whereas, you know, yeah, it's okay to do conversion therapy because I'm doing my therapy based on religious views, as opposed to looking at the research on conversion therapy or reparative therapy and seeing that the research shows not only does it not work, it's really harmful for people. So here again, science versus, you know, people's feelings. My favorite line from any SVU I ever did was a mother, and again, we posed this question. It's a mother who has a five-year-old, and she took him to the park, and she didn't vaccinate him. And she's the good mother. She gives her kid organic food and, you know, a lot of time for play and imaginative, you know, storytelling and things like that, versus the mother, played by Hilary Duff, who's not the good mother. She's a party goer, and her baby dies. And they think that she has killed her baby, but it actually turns out that the baby died of measles, and we don't vaccinate children under a year because they're not ready for it. And so the question is, this mother took her less than one-year-old to the park. That one-year-old was exposed to measles and contracted it and died. So what is the five-year-old's mother's responsibility to her own child? Because Wendy brought this up, shouldn't parents make this decision? Versus the community.
I said that in a different context.
Of course you did. I know. Yeah. But that's the point that I'm making, is that parents will say, it's my decision to make these decisions. And that's what this mother says in our episode. It is my decision to decide what's best for my child. But that child had measles and exposed another child, and that child died.
This is the same argument we're still having about COVID and masking and,
yeah.
and vaccine, yes. and safety in public spaces.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, what is your responsibility to your own child and your own beliefs versus the community of children? And this is really problematic, because people want the so-called freedom, and yet their freedom can kill a child. And that's what we said on our show. And that was quite controversial, because Stephanie March's character said, your decision killed another child. And she said, that's not fair. I'm the good mother, you know. But this mother also said, you know, when Stephanie said, doctors say that children should be vaccinated, and you have another opinion, then, you know, you're going against medical opinion. And she says, science is just another opinion. And that's my favorite line, because that's what we deal with nowadays.
So, yeah. And you just can't. I mean, freedom is not a thing that you have in isolation.
Exactly.
But we've reached the end of our hour. So I guess that we have to stop now. And we really appreciate you taking this time with us, especially with all you have going on.
I appreciate your having me. It was really kind of you.
Well, thanks so much.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.